It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Drug overdose is the leading cause of accidental death in the United States, and opioid addiction is driving the epidemic. Now, other states are in worse shape than we are here in Iowa. Still, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health, opioid-related emergency room visits in Iowa have more than doubled in the past decade. And in 2016, the number of confirmed opioid overdose deaths here in the state climbed 10% to 67. 67 confirmed opioid deaths in the state due to overdose in 2016. In just a few minutes, I'll be joined by Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell. The two of us will be talking with some Iowa lawmakers, debating legislation to address the crisis. But first, Lori Peter is with us, a mother from Cascade, Iowa, Cascade in the northeast part of the state. Lori Peter lost her oldest son, Kelly, to a heroin overdose in August of 2015. Lori, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So sorry to hear about your son. It must be so painful still. We're glad to have you on so that you can share your story, and hopefully some good can come of it. I assume that's why you share his story.
That's exactly why I share my story, yes.
I want to reach out to our listeners as we listen to Lori's story. We'd like to have you join us. If you have a personal experience that relates to our discussion today, the opioid epidemic, opioid abuse, and overdose, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. Lori, please, tell us what you can about the circumstances surrounding Kelly's overdose in August of 2015.
Well, the problem really that we had with it was when he was going through his addiction, there weren't all the resources, which we're still trying to get now, but there wasn't really anyone for me to reach out to. So that's what we're trying to change now, is bring awareness, prevent this, hopefully, but for the ones who are already in full addiction, help for them, and to really bring awareness to Iowans how this is starting and things that can be done to stop this from escalating to this level and of losing so many people.
Mm-hmm. Fortunately, many families have not been touched by heroin. Tell us, how did it start with your son using heroin? At what age?
I don't know the exact age, but I believe he was about 18 years old, and it started with prescription pain pills, hydrocodone. That's usually what people think of as hydrocodone, Vicodin, that type of thing that he had found in leftover in medicine cabinets.
Mm-hmm. So he had not been prescribed this for some medical condition. He found it in your cabinet or a neighbor's or a friend's?
Right. It could have been mine. It probably was a friend's parents. But he's kind of rare. The majority of people, it's 4 out of 5 heroin users actually started with a prescription opiate that was prescribed to them.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't really fit that mold, but the majority of them are actually prescribed the medication first.
When, as his mother, did you notice something? Did you, or thinking back, when did you notice there was an addiction developing?
Honestly, after the age of 18 is when I really noticed. He had been hospitalized, and they blamed it on a different drug. But now, looking back, it actually was the opiates.
Mm-hmm. And how was he explaining it?
Well, he was telling me he was using other drugs, but then once I really noticed and confronted him about it, he fully admitted what he was doing.
Mm-hmm. And like any parent, you sought help. You were, I'm sure, very distressed and sought help. How did you reach out? What did you find in terms of resources available here in Iowa?
None. I'm going to be honest. Short-term treatments, which are not effective.
Mm-hmm.
He would go to treatment, and they would let him out after 21 days. The longest one he was in was 28. There really isn't, and this addiction is long-term recovery, basically for the rest of their life. And there really wasn't anything, and that's why I'm speaking out, is so the next mom will have something the next person will have something and they won't be left alone.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any other experiences where you perhaps went to a medical facility, a hospital, trying to find a treatment? I understand you are an RN, so this is something, an area very familiar to you. What was the most perhaps surprising and disappointing instance of not being able to get help for your son?
When he wanted help very badly, taking him to the emergency room and being turned away because they were saying that detoxing from this medication wasn't an emergency. They didn't have any room for him. And basically, you know, try again some other day. Maybe there will be a bed. At one point, I was actually told, you take him home, you're an RN, you detox him.
Mm-hmm.
So wow. It's very frustrating, and many yeah. people are turned away because there isn't anywhere for them to go.
Mm-hmm. I know it must be very painful to take us back to that day, but tell us about August of 2015. What he had been clean several times, or tried to get clean several times, and then what happened?
Yes, he had. He had successfully gotten clean, but then he'd fall back into it. And the last period, he had been clean for the longest he had been clean in 6 years. I'm thinking it was more like 8 months. And I had given him a ride into Dubuque because he had to attend a class, his last class that he was required to attend. And after the class, the drug dealer was outside waiting for him and gave him some heroin.
Mm.
And he held on to it all day long. And took it back to his dad's house that night. And at this point, before this, when he would use heroin, it wasn't to get high. It was to feel normal, because when you're coming off of heroin or any opiates, when you're using, you don't really have that high anymore because your tolerance is so high. But this particular time, he was doing it to actually get high. And he used what he had normally used before, and he died. I received a call in the morning that he was dead.
So
it wasn't even a thought in our mind because he had been doing so well, but
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, if he had had possibly long-term medication-assisted treatment that is now available, but if he had had that option, he possibly wouldn't have had the desire to use that day.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we're trying to get insurance companies to cover is so they can recover, because it is long-term. They can't just stop using and that's it. The desire will be there forever.
Yeah. What were your feelings after your son's death? I'm trying to imagine being in your place. I'm a father of three children, grown children, and anyone listening with children can especially empathize with you. Is it anger? What is it that you feel mostly after something like that?
Oh, boy. Probably every emotion you've ever felt. Of course, you're mad. Guilt. Guilt is a huge one.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, probably every emotion, every negative emotion you've ever felt in your life, they come and go back and forth, but anger and guilt are really, really big ones.
Mm-hmm. Anger at the state, at our state, at its laws, at its lack of resources?
That, as well as, of course, the dealers. Angry at myself, just angry, and definitely that there isn't help. When he cried out for help and we tried to get help over and over again, there was no help.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, yes, the anger is definitely, I'm very disappointed in our state. There are other states. I love my state, but there are so many other states around us that have resources and they're having great success. And I really wish Iowa would follow along.
Mm-hmm. How unusual was your son's overdose in your, in, let's just say, in your area in Northeast Iowa where you're acquainted?
How unusual?
How unusual. How many other cases like your son's do you know of?
Quite a few, and it's very typical that they will be doing very well and clean for quite some time, and then they use the same amount that they had previously been using and overdose, or they use what they believe to be heroin, and it's fentanyl, our carfentanil. It's a substance much stronger than heroin, and they use, when they think they're using the normal dose, they're actually using a lethal dose of this medication, and it kills them. It will kill them.
Mm-hmm. Lori Peter is with us, a mother from Cascade, Iowa. In 2015, she lost her oldest son to a heroin overdose, and she's speaking out, sharing her story with us today that others can learn, and perhaps laws can be changed. Join our conversation, especially if you have a personal experience that relates to our discussion today, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Let's actually go to, I'm having trouble going to our phones, but let's try and go to Olivia in Iowa City, if we can get her on the air. Olivia, are you there?
Yes.
Thank you for joining us. What is your connection to this discussion?
I myself am a recovering heroin addict.
You are. How long were you addicted, from when to when?
My story is very similar to the lady that was just speaking, and my condolences to her. I can't imagine the pain that she is experiencing. My addiction started with other drugs, and like many others, like I started with pills like Vicodin and hydrocodone, and you know, I went to rehab a few times. The first time I was 18, and you know, the evil rehab is a great thing, but it's also kind of like a necessary evil in a way, because that's where I met like all of the people that I ended up relapsing with, and that's actually how I found out about heroin.
Mm-hmm. When, how many times have you thought you made it, you've been clean, and I don't know if that's the correct way to phrase it, and then gone back to heroin?
I've had a lot of tries at getting clean. My longest was 9 months, which was in 2015, but I'd say I've been trying off and on since I was 18, and today is actually my 21st birthday, so it's been like 3 years now.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been clean now?
Like 2 weeks.
2 weeks. That's very early on. What are you most concerned about when you think that you may break down and take some heroin? What are the chief things that would break you?
You know, actually, I had a situation. One of my really close friends from rehab just actually overdosed and died on heroin about a week ago.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And that was something that really I struggled with, and I really wanted to use over. You know, it doesn't make sense. Wanting to get high when somebody that close to you died because of that reason. But the disease of addiction just doesn't make sense, even to people that have it. Like, my mom will ask me all the time for me, like, to explain what it's like, what it feels like, what makes me, like, get high when I'm doing so well, staying clean. But it's something that's just really not easily explained. Like, the way addiction works is really, it's a mental disease, and like every morning I wake up and like I have to take certain steps every single day to fight this disease so that it doesn't win. And like things like that include, and the healing process would be like, I have a support system that I call, and I do therapy, and I did outpatient for a while, and like writing and meditating and praying. And there's just a whole number of things that addicts have to do on a daily basis so that they have protection against when things like friends dying happens. Because if I don't have those precautionary practices going on in my life, and something like my friend Bella dying of an overdose, then that's when I become most vulnerable to relapse.
Mm-hmm. Lori Peter, you're listening to Olivia's story as a recovering addict to heroin. This must sound very much like Kelly, does it, before he died?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
What is your reaction to Olivia's story here? We wish her all the best. And, you know, to stay clean, Olivia. What else would you add, Lori?
Reach out to as many people as you can to keep that support going. Every day is going to be a struggle, as you already know that. And congratulations on 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Lori, tell us about CRUSH. It's a group that you're involved with. The acronym stands for Community Resources United to Stop Heroin.
Yes. We're just people. We're moms. We're parents. Some of us have lost children or relatives or loved ones. Some of us have family or people we know, loved ones in active addiction. It's just the community coming together to try and find as many resources and put resources together, get the word out. We need to educate. We need to prevent. We need to help. It's just ordinary people, moms like me, together trying to figure this out all as one.
Mm-hmm. How do you find out about CRUSH?
You can find us on Facebook. Just Google Community Resources United to Stop Heroin, CRUSH, and reach out. We're started out in Dubuque with the first chapter, and now we're spreading all over Iowa. It's so big. We were originally CRUSH of Eastern Iowa, and now we've had to change our name to CRUSH of Iowa, and we're spreading. So this is the best thing we can do, a coalition of people who care, who want to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And if you connect with us, if we don't have the help immediately available, we will find it.
Mm-hmm. Laws are changing, hopefully, for the better here. We'll talk about that in the next half hour. But let's talk a little bit about what you mentioned, education and mindset. And if Olivia is still there, I want to ask her in just a moment. Lori, as you've immersed yourself in this topic, heroin addiction, opioid addiction, what are the misconceptions? What do we need to change? What mindsets need to be enlightened and how?
Oh, drug users are losers. You know, they're lower citizens, lower class people. Totally false. They're doctors, they're nurses, they're lawyers. It can be anyone. I just spoke with an old grade school friend of mine. She reached out to me that her dad, in his 70s, was using opiates for chronic pain in another state. Came back to Iowa, come to find out they had him on 4 different types of opiates, and he was in full addiction, and they were trying to get him to come off of them, and then they experienced the full withdrawal, and they never in a million years would have dreamed that their dad would be an addict. So it's just the perception of who these people are. They're brilliant people.
Mm-hmm.
They have PhDs. It can affect anyone. All it takes is a prescription for opiates, and anyone who takes them even longer than a week has the potential to be addicted.
Mm-hmm. Olivia, if you're still there in Iowa City as a recovering heroin addict, what else? What else does our culture, do we need to learn about this type of addiction?
I mean, you pretty much hit it on the head. There's just, like, this huge misconception that, and, like, I will spend hours on Facebook. I don't know why I do this to myself, but, like, reading comments, like, really mean things people say about addicts, like, on articles. I'm sure you saw the one picture of, like, the two parents that were, like, knocked out from heroin with their kid in the backseat and things like that being spread around in the media. People are shaming addicts, and what people don't understand that aren't addicts is that, I mean, as an addict, we shame ourselves enough. Like, we don't need society to be shaming us. You know what I mean? Like, it's the worst part about addiction is all of the people that it hurts. Like, as an addict, I can say that it does get to a point where I feel like I have no control over what I'm doing, and, like, I have no control over whether I get high or not. Like, if you get deep enough in it, you have no control over your actions. And you feel horrible about that. And what people tend to see and judge us about is just how we are in our addiction. And we don't even like how we are in our addiction. I'll speak for myself. I don't like how I am in my addiction. And there's just this whole stigma about addicts, and specifically, like, I'd say heroin, meth, crack addicts, that they're, like, horrible people and that we chose to be addicted. And I mean, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, hey, this is a great day to start my addiction to heroin. Like, nobody dreams of that when they're a child, you know? Like, pretty much the thing that just bothers me the most is just the negativity. And, like, what addicts need is a more understanding society that's willing to help them and pick them up, we need rehabilitation, not jail. We need support, not shaming. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple minutes left. I want to ask you both before we go, what is at the top of the list as far as laws that Iowa needs to change? Here, Lori Peter, you first of all, please.
We need the medicated assisted treatment. We need that covered by insurances. We need the Good Samaritan law so people aren't afraid to call 911 when someone overdoses. We need doctors to be required to check the prescription monitoring program so people aren't doctor shopping, getting multiple prescriptions. And if I might quickly add, another way to contact us on Crush is if you text heroin, the word heroin, to 51555, that will come back to you that you can connect with us.
Mm-hmm.
And Olivia, I would love for you to get a hold of me. I want your contact information before we're done here.
Olivia, we have just a few seconds, unfortunately. Anything to add to what Lori said as far as what our lawmakers can do?
I mean, again, she hit it on the head. I went to Minnesota to recover for the past 3 years. I actually recently just moved back. And the most important thing that she said is probably the Samaritan's law, because they have a law just like that in Minnesota, and it saves lives every single day. People need to not be afraid to save lives because they're afraid of getting in trouble. Like, being able to call 911 when somebody overdoses, and like normalizing having Narcan and things that will prevent overdose and death needs to be something that's more socially accepted.
Okay, we have to end this discussion. Olivia and Lori, thank you so much. You have helped enlighten. I can't tell how many people. I'm sure it's very many, but your courage in coming forth, Olivia, as a recovering heroin addict, we're all rooting for you, Olivia. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lori Peter, we're so sorry you lost your son in 2015 to a heroin overdose. Thank you for having the courage to tell your story of your loss there so that other mothers and fathers, loved ones, won't experience the pain that you have.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, I'll be joined by Iowa Public Radio's Joyce Russell. We'll talk with two state lawmakers about bills addressing this overdose epidemic. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about substance abuse and overdose. Drug overdose, the leading cause of accidental death in the United States. Opioid addiction driving this epidemic. Now, other states are in worse shape than Iowa, but according to the Iowa Department of Public Health, opioid-related emergency room visits more than doubling in the last decade in our state. In 2016, the number of confirmed opioid overdose deaths here in our state, 67. That's an increase of 10%. 67 confirmed opioid deaths in Iowa in 2016. I'm joined now by Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell. And we're going to talk with lawmakers debating legislation to address the crisis. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
After the powerful testimonials we had, the sharing of stories in the last half hour from a mother who lost a son in 2015 here in Iowa to heroin overdose and also a recovering heroin addict, give us an overview before we talk in detail of what's been happening in the legislature to address this crisis.
Well, there was a bill in the Senate that would have put into place the Good Samaritan legislation that we just heard the advocates asking for. This is the legislation that would grant immunity to anyone who's in a situation there with a friend or a loved one who is overdosing. They're afraid to call for help. This bill would, because they've been using as well, this bill, the Good Samaritan legislation, would free them from legal liability and encourage them, and in that way encourage them to get help. That was stricken from another bill in the Senate The law enforcement community opposes that. And then the other avenue that the legislature is taking has to do with the prescription drug monitoring program. This is the program that's been in effect for a while, where doctors and pharmacists can, if they're making a prescription or filling a prescription, they can go into this database and, in effect, find out if someone has been doctor shopping. When they are prescribing a medicine, they would go in and say so, and then another doctor faced with the patient could go and be able to tell, no, this patient just got this from another doctor or just got this from another pharmacy. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of bills dealing with that prescription drug monitoring program. The issue there is whether or not to require doctors to use it. There is legislation out there to require them to register with the database, but so far no legislation to require them to use it, although there is a bill being worked on in the House in the Oversight Committee, which is not subject to the funnel, that would require doctors to not just register with the program, but to use it.
With you there at the State House Law Library is State Senator Brad Zahn, a Republican from Urbandale. Senator Zahn, welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you, Ben. Thank you.
Let's talk first about the Good Samaritan bill, which you've been involved with, Senator. Tell us what's happening right now and how much support there is. Now, this bill that's still alive deals with alcohol or more than alcohol?
It is alcohol-related. I can tell you that the current status is it was passed through the Senate 49-0, and it's passed through a House committee, I assume Judiciary Committee. So it is still something that's still eligible. It's still live and past the final deadline. Mm-hmm. But what I did is I started with legislation that did include drugs. Actually, it was all the regents, student senates came together, UNI, Iowa, and Iowa State. And this was our number one priority. We had a subcommittee meeting, got law enforcement involved, as well as people from our judicial branch. And it kind of talked through everything. And then what this bill allows is it allows someone that's under the age of 21 years of old and that are consuming alcohol mm-hmm. to have amnesty from not only from any kind of law enforcement charges, but also the regents couldn't discipline that student. Mm-hmm. And it also gives amnesty to the person that requires the emergency services.
Right. Senator, are there cases that you've heard where a person lost a life to alcohol blood poisoning because someone was afraid to call emergency services?
We didn't have any individual testimony, and my heart goes out to Lori. And the son of her son, Kelly. And this is kind of an example of what happens. I want to make it very clear, and I got accused of promoting alcohol in our colleges, mm-hmm. and that's far from truth. They need to obey the laws that they're consuming alcohol, their age is 21, but the reality is, as this is going on in our youth today, it doesn't matter, this law wouldn't matter if you're a college student or not, it just gives you amnesty to get someone some help.
Mm-hmm. Okay, join our conversation. If you're listening, you have a personal experience that relates to our discussion today, trying to prevent drug overdose, alcohol overdose, in this case with this Good Samaritan bill, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Joyce mentioned, Senator Zahn, that the protection for those helping heroin users, for heroin users, was taken out. Tell us about that debate. Were you in favor? I assume you were in favor of keeping it in and having the same Good Samaritan type action for those trying to save those potentially overdosing on heroin.
That'd be correct. Like I said, we had people in from law enforcement and the judiciary system, and they were very opposed. I wanted to move the legislation, keep the conversation going, and it's something that we might go back and have a conversation as. The judicial system was very concerned about a drug dealer being involved and not being able to have charges against them. And so I was happy that we got this done because it is an epidemic in our colleges and with youth. I think a lot of kids make poor choices underage and consume alcohol or a lot of alcohol. And so when we had the students come in, they talked about situations in regards to someone might have be having a seizure or drank too much. And I'm not going to go into all the details, but that's what I'm not, obviously I'm a little bit disappointed, but this is a big step because this bill has been talked about for years to get it through the Senate 49-0. And then headed to the House, and I feel very optimistic that this will be approved.
Mm-hmm. With the alcohol clause here, that will be a big step. And then perhaps in the future, try to expand it to answer law enforcement's concerns to include harder drugs, illegal drugs?
That would be, obviously we'll have to do that next year or any time in the future to have that conversation. But they were very opposed.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the second Joyce. You mentioned the Iowa Prescription Monitoring Program. It goes by the acronym PMP. Also with us is Representative Jared Klein from Kyoto. Welcome to you, Representative Klein.
Thanks for having me this morning.
So let's talk a little bit about this. Iowa's the Prescription Monitoring Program. You've had managed a number of bills on the House floor dealing with prescription drugs. Tell us what's happening.
Yeah, I've been dealing with this issue for many years, and we've heard from one mother who I've met there a couple different times, and some other folks, and this is one of those issues that just rips your heart out. So I've been working on this for multiple years. The prescription monitoring program is just one piece of the things we talk about. Last year, we were successful in getting Narcan out there to not just first responders, but to the general public. And we had that discussion last year about the Good Samaritan law. I think there's still some middle ground we can find there. But when we talk about the prescription monitoring program, one of the problems we have right now is only 42% are registered to use the PMP now. So we've been doing things from the House to try to get that number up, to get more people access there. Another bill we did this year, which was a direct result of meeting with medical examiners, healthcare professionals this summer, dealt with allowing their investigators and the examiners themselves to have access to the PMP so that they start to see a trend in people that are dying from overdose, that they can have access to that, and we could start to get to the root of the problem. So we tried multiple things. We do the Narcan, the Naloxone. We talk about the PMP. We also try to make sure the dollars are there for our drug courts and for treatment. We do have the Iowa Department of Public Health has a lot of resources on their website for treatment, and we try to make sure those things are getting taken care of in the way they need to be. PMPs are just one part of this overall problem of dealing with prescription drug and opioid abuse.
Mm-hmm. You referred to Narcan and Naloxone. Those are the antidotes to a drug overdose.
That would be correct. The ones that delay it but don't necessarily end it. They delay it long enough for people to be able to get emergency assistance.
And that's now available without a prescription.
I believe that's correct, yes, for the general public and the folks at home. Because, you had one of the people that was talking before talked about educating people on drug users aren't losers. This is one of those prime examples of that, because when you talk about prescription drug abuse and Narcan, this isn't about having a product available for the drug dealer to be able to give to a customer of theirs that's sitting there ODing on their couch. This may be a case of a son or a daughter who's parent is in an elderly state, maybe forgot they took their prescription already once, they take it a second time, they're in an overdosing situation, that those folks are also the ones that have access. This isn't just about those that are abusing. This is a wide-reaching, all-encompassing issue that a lot of this really actually goes back to the source of this. You need to, for the public to look at this, because I've asked this many times, is how did we end up here? You look at the history, you talk about the late 90s, the medical community got pressure to start to look at pain more increasingly, that they thought they weren't treating it enough. And that's where it ended up with pain being considered, quote unquote, the fifth vital sign. So that doctors now went maybe to the other extreme and trying to address it. We need the medical community working with us. How do we rein this back in? We have a few things identified. What can we be doing next then?
On your bill, then, one of your bills would require doctors to register with the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. It would not require them to use the program. when the bill came up in the House, there was an amendment. It was argued for by Representative John Forbes, who is himself a pharmacist in his life outside the legislature. That was voted down on a voice vote. In the Senate, there is going to be a similar amendment to mandate use of the prescription drug monitoring program, not just require doctors to register, but to use it. There's also a separate bill in the House that Representative David Heaton is working on to require the use. Can you get behind requiring doctors to use it, Representative Klein?
I think whenever we can have things optional and get buy-in from the people that are supposed to be doing it is better than mandating anything. So I'm open to hearing the arguments from the physicians and folks on both sides of this. But I want them to have buy-in. I want to make sure this is set up right, because if their reason for opposing a mandate to use it is logical and reasonable and we need to do a change, then we can do that. But so far, I'm not hearing a whole lot on that end, so I'm still open to figuring out how to walk that line when we talk about physicians. Pharmacists is a little different.
Representative Jared Klein is with us, along with State Senator Brad Zahn, as we talk about legislation to address the opioid epidemic, drug abuse, overdoses, and so forth. With Joyce Russell and myself, we have just less than 10 minutes left. Let's get Dr. Michael Romano into this conversation. He's a family medicine physician from Council Bluffs, also the chair of the Iowa Medical Society Board. Dr. Romano, how good of you to join us. Thank you for being part of our discussion.
Thanks for allowing me to participate.
You've been listening to the discussion for several minutes. As a family physician, do you support the Prescription Monitoring Program, PMP?
Yes, I do support. I think the real issue or the point that we probably need to decide is how that information gets into the hands of our prescribers. You know, we're absolutely in favor of this information being in front of the prescribers at the point of prescribing. I think the real issue of argument is how do you do that? You know, do you do that by a mandatory bill to utilize a tool that is not yet quite ready for prime time from the physician point of view, or can you do it by another method?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the real argument.
Yeah, to talk about your hesitation, not ready for prime time, do you mean technically the prescription monitoring program is technically not something you have confidence in, so you would not want to mandate the use of it at this time?
Well, you know, one of the issues from the physician point of view is really the timeliness of information. And I know there's a bill out there currently to address that timeliness. So for a patient who accesses a prescription for a controlled substance, the pharmacy has up to a week to get that information into the system. So that delay obviously presents problems with if a patient is actively doctor shopping, that week could potentially give them plenty of time to access other physicians. And where even if there was a mandatory law in place, that prescriber would not know that patient had received narcotics from another source. I think the other issue that's out there is really the interface between electronic health records. You know, the government has forced the issue with electronic health records. And what we have now is a system whereby as the prescriber is accessing that electronic health record, they have to leave that record to access another database. So why can't that database interface with the electronic health records that are currently there? This should be technologically a fairly easy thing to do. So why is it that at the point where that patient's record is pulled up electronically, doesn't the prescriber actually see that? That information in front of them and allow them to identify that. I think the other issue, which Representative Klein, I think, addressed some of these issues is, okay, what do I do with it now? So I've identified an individual who is perhaps addicted or is perhaps illegally diverting medications. Where do my primary physicians turn to next? Because not prescribing is certainly part of the process, because the addiction issue starts with prescribing, but it doesn't end with not prescribing. So you've identified this individual, and then what? You know, when I look at my physicians in the state of Iowa, over 80% of them practice in rural communities of less than 5,000 individuals. So are there going to be addiction services available to those patients that I can take this individual and offer them a resource that will provide the support to get them to address their addiction? Currently, there are many communities where we don't have the counseling or behavioral health or addiction services available. Or if it's a legal issue, who do I contact in that instance? You know, again, physicians don't necessarily have the training to know what to do next. I think our point is this information is existing in the database, and it's a critical public health issue. Why is it that the physicians are the ones responsible for having to pull that information? Why isn't that information pushed out to physicians? And why aren't regulators from a state level or the criminal justice people already accessing that? You know, currently, criminal justice cannot access that database without a subpoena. Mm-hmm. If we really think that there's somebody that is illegally diverting these medications, why is a subpoena necessary? Why isn't this considered enough of a public health issue that they're allowed to act on the data that exists in the system itself? You know, if I had a patient with active tuberculosis or a meningitis patient or measles or a venereal disease, they lose the privilege of having that be private information. Those become public health issues that is mandatory that information is shared with public health departments so that we can control those infectious diseases. Why is it that opioid dependence isn't treated similar to some of those public health problems, where some of that privilege of confidentiality is removed if you're one of the individuals that may be abusing these drugs?
I know that one of the issues here that complicates it is HIPAA, the Federal Health Information System, where confidentiality of patients' records comes into the picture. But Dr. Romano, I'd also like to ask you about very briefly another bill this year that did not advance, would have addressed the problem of how many pills doctors prescribe. And there was a bill that would have sort of made it easier to have a smaller number, not 60, not 40, maybe 20, to start like that. Is that something that doctors should be thinking about more?
I think so. I think you know, part of what we have to do is probably define the scope of the problem. You know, you look at the data that was released by the PMP program, to the letter sent to Governor Branstad detailing the statistics. You know, there was a very, very minuscule percentage of individuals that may have been abusing those drugs out of the 733,000 individuals who had a narcotic prescription. 236 or 234 actually might have been flagged as abusing. So when it comes to limiting the size of the prescription given, are you burdening those 700,000+ individuals who have legitimate uses for narcotic pain medications to protect the 0.3% that may be abusing? I think that's the argument that comes into play.
Dr. Romano, thank you very much. I wanted to give 30 seconds, perhaps, to our representatives here, our lawmakers, to sum up or emphasize something they wanted to as we close this program. Representative Jared Klein, can you, in 20 seconds, tell us what you'd like to emphasize?
Well, I just really want to emphasize that we're taking continuous steps on this issue. It was good to hear from Dr. Romano there. Those are some very helpful points that we're going to take back and see what we can do to mix those in.
Okay, State Senator Brad. Yeah, Brad's on.
Yes, thank you. And I would just tell you that we're talking about justice reform. There's too many drug addicts that are in our prison systems. Tell Olivia to stay strong, and I'll be praying for her.
Okay, very good. State Senator Brad's on with us, Republican Representative Jared Klein as well. As often, too much to discuss to get it into an hour, but we I think we did a pretty good job. Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent, thank you. River to Rivers, produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer.